Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I do think we should get back to the point, as we did back in the 1800s, where most people tap their trees to collect sap and to make sugar in the springtime.
Michael Farrell says if you have trees on your land, you should be collecting sap. We'll talk to him today about the history of maple sugaring and where he sees it going in the future. Tim Burton of Burton's Maplewood Farm lets us taste some of his barrel-aged maple syrup. There's some lemon zest and spices in there. More sweet maple goodness with a creme brulee recipe. Harvest Public Media looks at the various support programs farmers can sign up for and why some people are concerned about drone use in farming. And bread baking, big and small. All on today's show. We combed food news headlines this week to compile our update. Luann Johnson has three stories.
Meatpackers and industry groups have lost ground in their push against USDA rules that require country of origin labels on meat products, also called COOL. The labeling law requires information about where meat was born, raised, and slaughtered. It also prohibits mixing meat from different countries in one package. Multinational companies have led the charge against the rule, which affects trade between Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. The U.S. Cattlemen's Association and the National Farmers Union and others have sided with the USDA, saying opponents have overblown the rule's estimated economic burden on companies. The end of the lawsuit does not mark the label law's last hurdle. The World Trade Organization ruled last October that the label law violates U.S. trade between Canada and Mexico. Industry opponents plan to press Congress to alter the law to comply with the WTO's ruling, and Canada's agriculture minister met with members of the U.S. Agriculture Committees in early February to push for changes to the rule. What gives Butterfinger candy bars that orange coloring? A little bit of synthetic dye red 40 mixed with yellow 5. But by the end of this year, those artificial colors will be replaced by annatto, which is a natural coloring agent from the fruit seeds of the achiote tree. And it's not just Butterfingers, but all of Nestle's candy products that are being affected. The company will change 75 recipes to remove all artificial flavors and colors. Nestle says it looked at recent survey results and are trying to tailor their products to be more in line with consumer preferences. And Kraft Foods announced a 62% decline in profits over the past year, and as a result, changed up their leadership. Chairman and CEO John Cahill replaced Tony Vernon as CEO in December. In addition to Kraft, Kellogg Company and ConAgra Foods have pared back their expectations for profits and earnings this year. Cahill has said the company needs to find out what consumers want. Nielsen's 2015 Global Health and Wellness Survey asked 30,000 people their thoughts on healthy food and found that 88% are willing to pay more for healthy foods. Analysts believe the shift is much larger than a health fad. We've got these stories online. Find the list of links in the newest post on our website. If you share them on Twitter or Facebook, be sure to tag us at Earth Eats.
Yep, and if you want to satisfy your sweet tooth with something homemade, we have plenty of recipes for cakes and cookies and sweets of all sorts at eartheats.org. Luann Johnson, stay warm.
Ha, no kidding. It's definitely hot cocoa weather.
American taxpayers spend billions of dollars on agriculture programs to support the nation's farmers. Right now, across the Corn Belt, farmers are choosing their safety nets. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, their decisions over the next few weeks will have a huge influence on the total cost of the government programs.
If you're a farmer who loses, say, 15 to 25% of your crop, you're hurting. And your crop insurance probably won't help. That's where Farm Bill programs come in. These are government supports that help keep farmers afloat when prices or profits are down. And they're free for farmers.
This drop in prices has definitely meant that we're looking at an increase in expenditures on these Farm Bill programs.
That's Iowa State University economist Chad Hart. When lawmakers drafted the Farm Bill, they planned on relatively stable corn and soybean prices. But those have plummeted in the past year, throwing off all the estimates of what these programs would cost taxpayers.
Usually, if you average them out, they do a pretty good job. But, yeah, there are going to be years like this where they're going to, if you will, miss, and they miss on the low side in terms of projected spending.
By how much? Originally, lawmakers planned to spend $3.5 billion annually on these programs. But now, they're looking at $1.5 billion more per year than those predictions. Farmers are just signing up for these programs now, and which ones they choose also will impact the price tag for taxpayers.
Usually a farm bill is a take-it-or-leave-it type of deal. Here's the program. You can take it, or you can just not use the program at all. This time around, it's more like a menu. I get to pick and choose how I want to participate in this farm bill.
Farmers essentially have to decide whether they want some protection only when prices tank, or if they prefer a calculation that considers their revenue. And they only have until the end of March.
Again, we're trying to grab that nice, moist, wet soil.
Recently, 20,000 farmers visited the Iowa Power Farming Show in Des Moines. Amid the displays and demonstrations, tools and techniques, the sign-up deadline loomed. Yet many remained undecided.
I haven't made any decisions on mine yet.
No, it's confusing.
I don't think I want to.
Oh, boy.
The selection farmers make commits them for the life of the law, at least 5 years. Farmer John Paper of State Center, Iowa, has made his decision.
I mainly went through my crop insurance man, and he had a program and kind of went through my yields and base and kind of went with his recommendations. And so I'm probably going with ARC County for my farm.
I think I decided on the county average, the ARC County, just because for our operation, that's best fit.
And that's Michael Johnson of Kanawha, Iowa. They've both chosen agricultural risk coverage. That means whatever the price is, they'll get a government payout if their revenue is lower than a historical average. The other option is a price-only program that pays out whenever prices drop below a certain threshold. Corn has already done that this year. Since a bad year can cripple a farmer, these decisions are critical. In a recent call with reporters, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack said the USDA, farm groups, and universities have developed tools to help farmers decide.
We're pleased with the fact that there's been as much participation and interest in our outreach efforts.
And Vilsack noted the pressure to make the right choice.
We recognize that this is an important decision because it will govern activities for the life of the Farm Bill.
More immediately, it will help economists improve their estimates of just how many billions of dollars taxpayers are on the hook for. And then everyone will wait to see what really happens with prices. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
In the second half today, getting a bird's eye view of a field has its pluses and minuses. We look at the future of drones in farming. For Michael Farrell, it all started with taste.
Well, what got me hooked on sugaring was when I went to the pancake breakfast at my college forest, Sugar Bush, when I was studying forestry in grad school.
That was the first time he tried real maple syrup.
And it was just one of those enlightening moments. I had always had the artificial pancake syrup before then. And once I had tried it, I was hooked right away.
Farrell then did what most of us don't do, which is he tried making it himself. That's called sugaring. Like most DIY projects, it took a while for him to learn how to do it.
Screwed up a lot. It's hard to do it right. Eventually got it right, but in the meantime, I decided to just drink a lot of sap, and that's what I really loved.
Practice makes perfect because he's now the director of Cornell University's Maple Syrup Research and Extension Field Station in Lake Placid, New York. He taps almost 6,000 trees every spring, and not just maple trees, but also birch, black, walnut, and butternut trees. Birch syrup, by the way, tastes like a fruity molasses. He gets a whiff of raspberries as it's boiling. Anyway, getting maple syrup takes a lot of time and a little science, but as he said, the sap can be enjoyed straight out of the tree.
A lot of sugar makers drink sap as a seasonal beverage. I'm a huge sap drinker myself, and it tastes basically like water with just a hint of sweetness to it. Remember, there's only 2% sugar in it, and because there's so many minerals in it, it also has a distinct flavor as well.
Farrell is also the author of The Sugar Maker's Companion. The book aims to encourage all of us, at least anyone with trees on their property, to start sugaring or collecting sap. He says it's a way to return to our roots. The indigenous peoples of southeastern Canada and northeastern U.S. had collected sap and boiled it past syrup down to sugar. It was easier to store that way. European settlers then picked up the practice. Various technological advancements were made over the years, including the spout or spile in the early to mid-1800s. That was a way to collect sap without damaging the tree. In 1860, Americans had produced 40 million pounds of maple sugar and 1.6 million gallons of maple syrup, the most up to that point. But 25 years later, cane sugar became a viable alternative to the labor-intensive process of sugaring.
Once cane sugar became much cheaper, people stopped producing so much maple sugar because economically it didn't pay for them to do so.
Many producers switched to syrup instead, and now we see plastic tubing that helps get the sap from the trees to plastic tubs. A process called reverse osmosis removes three-quarters of the water from the sap, which makes it much quicker to boil it down to syrup. But Farrell says you don't need all this fancy technology to do this yourself. All it takes is a handful of trees and some patience.
I do think we should get back to the point, as we did back in the 1800s, where most people tapped their trees to collect sap and to make sugar in the springtime. We produced a far greater amount of maple sugar back in the 1800s than we do today. Yet today we have a lot more maple trees, and there's no reason why we can't produce and consume just as much maple sugar as we did back when people were really living off the land.
Michael Farrell can tell you so much more about starting your own mini maple farm in your backyard. His book is The Sugar Maker's Companion. We're excited to see Farrell speak at the National Maple Syrup Festival in early March. That's happening right here in southern Indiana, very proud to say. Details about that event are on our website, eartheats.org. Coming up, Daniel Orr just received a special delivery from maple syrup maker Tim Burton.
We zested a bunch of lemons over here at the restaurant, and we added the cinnamon, some star anise.
Kind of a Caribbean flair. It's kind of cool.
Find out what other special treatment this maple syrup received coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations, bloomingfoods.coop. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. I'm Annie Corrigan. Hello, you're with Earth Eats today. Tim Burton of Burton's Maplewood Farm stops in to see Chef Daniel Orr fairly regularly. Today he has something special in tow, something they've been collaborating on, barrel-aged maple syrup.
I mean, that's pretty good, but it'll give you a little... So take a swig.
This stuff has been aged in Applejack brandy barrels from Starlight Distilleries in Starlight, Indiana. It was also seasoned with some spices and lemon peel.
We zested a bunch of lemons over here at the restaurant. We sent them over to the maple camp, and we added the cinnamon, some star anise, and the spices, and...
Kind of a Caribbean flair, you know? I mean, it's kind of cool. It's like no other barrel-aged maple syrup that we've done as of yet.
This syrup was tapped in February 2012 and poured into the barrels in May with seasonings. Twice a month, Burton fired the barrels to heat the syrup from the outside in to encourage the aging process. Then, after a year of developing flavors, it's ready for use in the restaurant.
Take me back to the beginning. Why did you decide initially to start fiddling with your maple syrup?
Well, you know, quite frankly, I just wanted to make maple syrup sexier. We just started looking around domestically for rum bourbon and brandy barrels. Obviously, the bourbon wasn't going to be an issue. We were wondering about where are we going to get our rum barrels? Are we going to have to go out of the country for the rum barrels? And we didn't have to do that because there's a small batch distiller in Tennessee called Pritchard's Distillery. And so Phil Pritchard said, come on down and get your rum barrels, and so we took off from there, yeah.
They're getting barrels from Breckenridge Distillery and High West Whiskey in Park City, Utah. Their collaboration with Brennan's in New Orleans sounds especially interesting. Tabasco bourbon barrel maple syrup. Tim Burton says he's having fun learning as he goes.
Initially, we started off with barrel aging our maple syrup for 6 months. And we were calling it good at 6 months. Well, we inadvertently aged some maple syrup for 12 months. We were doing some housekeeping in the maple house, and I went to move a brandy barrel, and it was heavy. We emptied it, and what do you know? There was like 30 gallons of syrup in there that we had put in there like a year ago type of thing. And not only was the brandy more prevalent in it, I mean, it was like three times stronger. So then we started taking a look at this and saying, hey, you know what? Maybe we should do this for 12 months opposed to six. Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Chef.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So how are you going to use this in what recipes?
Well, I think this is great just on, of course, pancakes and French toast and all that kind of stuff. But I think it would be wonderful in a creme brulee, a maple creme brulee. So I think it'll be delicious. It'll add that Caribbean flair. And when you add a little bit of saltiness to this, it's really going to kick it all the way up to get that sweet, salty, wonderful, spicy flavor.
Someone should try maple syrup on plank roasted salmon. Let us know how that tastes. Maple creme brulee, did you hear that on the list? Great idea. Here's pastry chef Emily Bolin. She's got 8 egg yolks ready to go, and she's whisking in some sugar.
And then we have a quart of steamed cream on the stove.
All right, do you want me to slowly start adding this?
Yes.
Chef Orr, you're pouring while you're whisking. Is this a tag team effort?
Usually you could probably do it by yourself. You just want to slowly add your heavy cream so that you don't cook and coagulate your egg yolks. So then we don't have scrambled eggs. Now I'm going to add a tablespoon of vanilla and then clove, allspice, cinnamon, nutmeg.
Whisking, ever whisking, ever whisking.
Yes. You want everything mixed together so that every bite tastes the same. Next, I'm going to add a third cup of the maple syrup.
And I see, what do I see? Little lemon chunks in there? Lemon zest?
Yes. Lemon especially will help bring the cinnamon and the sweetness out. And it just makes everything taste better when you add lemon.
I agree with you. I agree.
And now our mixture is done. It's really easy just to make that up, and it looks really runny. You'll think, how on earth will this bake together? But it does, I promise. So you just take it and ladle it into your ramekin or your dish. And you don't want to fill it too full, maybe about 3/4 the way or about 1/4 inch away from the top. And then you bake that in a water bath at 350 for about 40, 45 minutes, just until when you shake it, just a little ripple effect inside. Yeah, you don't want it to jiggle too much.
Chef Emily's got one ready for us.
And with the magic of radio.
And you have a lighter. Just a regular old light. Whoa! And then Chef comes with a torch.
You just want to sprinkle your sugar over your brulee. You just want it to kind of fill in all your little nooks and crannies on the brulee and kind of sink down in. It makes a nice little crust.
Oh, you are not going skimpy on that sugar. That's a... Oh, and then you're removing the excess.
Yes.
Okay. Now, if you were looking for an excuse to buy a blowtorch, here you go. She was able to get a perfectly even caramelization on the top of this beautiful result, and it tasted so good. Photos and the recipe at eartheats.org. Farmers want to use drones to get a bird's eye view of their fields, to find problem patches with crops, or even check in on sick cattle. Commercial use of drones is still widely banned in the U.S., but regulators recently released a draft of new rules. If they're approved, they could lead to an explosion in drone use on farms. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports.
On a breezy morning in rural Weld County, Colorado, Jimmy Underhill quickly assembles a black and orange drone with 4 spinning rotors. We're right next to a cornfield, littered with stalks left over from last year's harvest.
This one just flies itself. It's fully autonomous.
Underhill is a drone technician with Agrobotics, a Colorado-based drone startup that sees farmers as its most promising market. Today, he's training his fellow employees how to work the machine in the field.
So if you want to start it, we'll walk over to the drone. It's got a safety button on here. And now it'll start flying.
The quadcopter zips 300 feet into the air, directly above our heads, pauses for a moment, and then begins to move.
Now it's just turned to the east, and it's going to start doing its lawnmower pattern.
What makes the drone valuable to farmers is the camera on board. It snaps a high-resolution photo every 2 seconds. From there, Agrobotics stitches the images together, sniffing out problem spots in the process. Knowing what's happening in a field can save a farmer money. At farm shows across the country, drones have become as ubiquitous as John Deere tractors. The Colorado Farm Show earlier this year included an informational session telling farmers both the technical and legal challenges ahead.
I think it's a very exciting time.
That's farmer Darren Salvador. He grows 2,000 acres of wheat and corn near the Colorado-Nebraska border.
Can you look at areas of disease concern, insect concern? So now you can be more proactive and treat smaller areas and not treat the entire field.
Salvador and about 50 other farmers got an earful from Rory Paul, CEO of Volt Aerial Robotics, a St. Louis-based drone startup.
We really don't know what they're good for. We've got a few ideas where they could really benefit agriculture, the majority of which are still theoretical.
Theoretical because commercial drone use is still illegal in the U.S. Companies can apply for exemptions from the Federal Aviation Administration, but the requirements to get that exemption can be costly, like requiring drone operators to hold a private pilot's license.
These small drones that are almost priced to be expensive toys are not reliable, and that's a concern of the FAA.
Eric Frew studies drones at the University of Colorado Boulder. The FAA didn't respond to requests for comment for this story, but Frew says the agency is trying to find a balance. Putting a large flying machine in the hands of someone who's inexperienced can cause big problems.
When these systems work, they work fantastically. When they don't work, they don't work.
And while some farmers see drones as a way to help their bottom line, others see them as a potential invasion of privacy. Animal rights activists have used the machines to fly over large-scale livestock operations to expose abuse or environmental damage.
See it?
Not yet.
It's really hard to see.
Yeah.
Back at the cornfield in rural Colorado, Agrobotics president Tom McKinnon watches as the drone comes in for a landing.
We bash the FAA a lot. I mean, the FAA's job is air safety. And they have delivered on that. But when it comes to drones, they're badly fumbling the ball.
The FAA's draft rules on commercial drones are expected soon. McKinnon says until the agency gives some guidance to commercial drone operators, he'll be doing most of his work in countries like Australia and Brazil, where laws are friendlier to farm drones. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Hear more stories like these during NPR's news programs on weekdays. All stories from their reporters are archived at harvestpublicmedia.org. On these frigid days, there's something wonderful and sometimes necessary about baking. It makes the kitchen warm, it smells wonderful, and it keeps you busy if you're stuck inside. We've got two profiles of bread bakers. Mike Siebers bakes dozens and dozens of different loaves for the Feast Bakery Cafe. Keith Romaine is doing some small-time baking at his home, but he hopes to put a wood-fired oven in his backyard for his entire neighborhood to use. These two guys talk about how they balance precision with creativity in their baking. Up first, this is Mike.
The measuring process is very precise, like down to the gram. But I feel like the real skill in baking comes with knowing when the bread is fermenting correctly. What I'm doing right now, it is an espresso rye. When I was looking at rye recipes, dark rye recipes, most of them are colored with either molasses or instant espresso, which But I wasn't finding anything with espresso or coffee or anything in there. But I'm thinking back that, you know, 100 years ago, they didn't have instant espresso, so there has to be coffee in some of these recipes. So I just decided to try it, and it works. Sourdough is kind of a catch-all term, I guess, for natural leavened bread. Honestly, what I think the biggest thing that makes a good sourdough is allowing the yeast the time to do its thing. There's a bacteria that kind of lives with wild yeast that when it's feeding, it produces an acid. So the sour taste that you're getting is actually the acid that the bacteria is producing. That only happens if you allow the yeast to ferment the bread at a certain rate.
And I'm eating this bread when? Tomorrow?
Tomorrow. This will be baked sometime in the wee hours of the morning tonight.
Will you be here?
I will be here, yes.
How many hours do you work?
A lot. A lot. You have to be patient and let the yeast do its thing. There are many ugly stages of bread making, but the end is beautiful.
Breaking bread is a very old term for of communion, of like bringing community together. My name's Keith Romaine. It's kind of perfect that you're here right at the moment because the bread is moving faster than I had expected. Oh, here, you get to watch the whole process here. This is ready. It's like a fireplace, and you heat it up to about 700-800 degrees inside. And it has very thick masonry walls, 18 to 24 inches thick. And that holds the heat. And it holds it for about 4 hours at 500 degrees.
How's it looking?
It's looking really, really good. What people did in communities, different bakers would use the oven on different days. And then afterwards, you can make pastries, you can make pizzas, you can roast meat. Okay. My community has been so supportive and excited about it. And it's fun to be in the middle of something that's exciting. When I made my artwork, I would make it and hope that somebody liked it and it would be expensive. And this is really inexpensive, and it's like the best artwork I've ever made. I mean, it's nice to see my artwork on people's walls, but it's easier to make a living if they eat the art.
And then you're going to bake two more?
Yep. Okay. Preheat it to 500 again and stick those in.
Do it all over again. Keith Romaine, whose art is his bread baking. He's working on building that wood-fired oven in his backyard, as he was describing. Before him, Mike Siebers of Feast. If you're feeling inspired, find some baking recipes at eartheats.org. Our crew at Earth Eats is Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and all the folks at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations, bloomingfoods.coop. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. It's been good. Thanks for connecting with us today. And don't be a stranger. EarthEats.org. I'm Annie Corrigan.